for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. 45 years ago this month, President Lyndon Johnson delivered what many considered the greatest civil rights speech of his career. He hailed progress made for blacks in the Civil and Voting Rights Acts, but added, "Freedom is not enough." In a new book of that very title, historian James Patterson examines the report, which was penned by Daniel Patrick Moynihan. It became the basis for Johnson's speech. And Professor Patterson explains why it's inflamed American culture for half a century. James Patterson joins me in this studio. He is Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University and author of several books. This latest, again, is titled Freedom is Not Enough. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you, sir. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
President Johnson made this speech in a commencement address at Howard University. Set this up for us. Set the stage for us. Why did he decide the time had come?
Yes, the speech was given, as you say, to the graduates at Howard on almost exactly 45 years ago, on June 4th, 1965. And Moynihan, as you say, co-wrote the speech with Richard Goodwin, who was his top speechwriter. The background for this is that Moynihan, who was an assistant secretary of labor at that time in the Johnson administration, decided in late 64 that he wanted to write a report about the black family, mainly about the lower class or low-income black families in the cities, because in his report, he distinguished very clearly between those kinds of families and middle-class black families and middle-class black people who did not have the same problems that these people had. So he wrote this report at white heat and over the course of 3 months between January and March of 1965. Excuse me. And then had it printed in a basement of the Labor Department. They did 100 copies. They put 99 of them in the safe and circulated one. I think they actually circulated others because it did get around. But it was not meant to be a public document. And it was simply titled The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. Moynihan's name was not on the cover or anywhere in it, even though he was the sole author of it. Of course, he had help from the staff at the Labor Department. And it was a descriptive and very unflattering description of what was going on in the families.
Let's hear the heart of President Johnson's speech, this short clip delivered at Howard University's commencement on June 4th, 1965.
Freedom is not enough. You do not wipe away the scars of centuries by saying now, you are free to go where you want and do as you desire and choose the leaders you please. This is the next and the more profound stage of the battle for civil rights. We seek not just freedom, but opportunity. We seek not just legal equity, but human ability. Not just equality as a right and a theory, but equality as a fact and equality as a result.
Now, James Patterson, had the president stopped there, would the speech have created the controversy that it did subsequently?
No, the speech was well received, and some of the civil rights leaders, in fact, were told about the speech and had it read to them before he delivered it. Martin Luther King and others praised it. Johnson thought it was the greatest civil rights speech he'd ever made, and I think it was. What he really wanted to do, as he said, was to go beyond for blacks, giving freedom from segregation, as in the Civil Rights Act, and freedom from discrimination in voting, positive freedoms, social and economic freedoms, social justice, better housing, living conditions, and so forth.
And then he began to talk about the family.
Perhaps most important, its influence radiating to every part of life is the breakdown of the Negro family structure. For this, most of all, white America must accept responsibility. It flows from centuries of oppression and persecution of the Negro man. It flows from the long years of degradation and discrimination which have attacked his dignity and assaulted his ability to produce for his family. So unless we work to strengthen the family, to create conditions under which most parents will stay together, all the rest, schools and playgrounds and public assistance and private concern, will never be enough to cut completely the circle of despair and deprivation.
Those words are so powerful, the circle of despair and degradation.
I mean, I couldn't agree more with what he said, and this was Moynihan's feeling too, that at the root of any good society is strong family life. And if you don't have that and the children grow up without parents or without a father, they're almost certain to be poor and they have trouble in school and everything else follows.
So what was the reception, for example, by members of Congress?
I don't really know. I didn't read anything that suggested it. Anybody disagreed with them. There were people who thought, well, the problems were so deeply entrenched that there was probably no really good way to solve them, which turns out to have been true, except a lot of things we haven't tried. There are others who, many conservatives, for instance, who think these people are hopeless and you really can't do much for them, and it's just a waste of government money. And those were people, of course, who had opposed the Civil Rights Act anyway.
But clearly Lyndon Johnson, Daniel Patrick Moynihan,
yes,
felt otherwise.
Totally. Moynihan was a Catholic, and he had a kind of a Catholic notion of the importance of family, and a solid family, and no divorce and so forth. I mean, not that he was opposed to divorce, but he really felt families were the basic building block, just as Johnson said.
It's interesting because Daniel Patrick Moynihan came from kind of a hard scrabble family himself.
Yes, his father was an alcoholic and left the family when he was 10. Moynihan had a younger brother and a younger sister. They were then living in New York City, and they struggled very, very hard in the late years of the Depression. His father left in 1938, and when she remarried in 1940, things got a little bit better, and when the Depression ended, she got a decent job, and they moved to the suburbs in Queens, actually. So it's not fair to say that he grew up in a slum. He never lived in Harlem. He never even lived in Hell's Kitchen, as some of his later newspaper stories seem to indicate. But he had a tough childhood. He knew what it was like to be alone. He sold papers in Times Square and so forth as a newsboy.
So what did both he and President Johnson believe the role of government to be in trying to introduce strengthening mechanisms for the family?
Well, they felt that something could be done. I mean, the subtitle was The Case for National Action. But the report itself was very, very silent about precisely what should be done. Once again, I return to the fact that it was an in-house document. It was supposed to be circulated to top advisors. It was not supposed to be published. It didn't have his name on it.
But it got leaked.
Yeah, I'll come to that. But He didn't claim to really know what should be done. He wanted people to read his report and know how bad the situation was, then to sit down and do a decent job. In this sense, he was a very good liberal. He just didn't walk up on the, as a senator, he wouldn't get up and say, here's a problem, give me $1 billion. He would want to study it. He was an intellectual, he was a social scientist, and he realized that there were a lot of things that were very complicated and needed a lot of study before you did them on a large scale. So you read the report and you're not going to find the answers.
So when the report got leaked, mm-hmm. what happened and how did it get leaked?
The report was leaked. As I say, Johnson gave a speech on June 4th. The report was leaked gradually to reporters starting in early August and on into late August. Then the government produced, through the government printing office, actually you could buy a copy of it for 45 cents, but you had to ask for it. In other words, these were not sitting on newsstands, and most people never read the Moynihan Report. It's actually never been, was not actually printed as a document until 1981 by a press. It's printed in other places. So what happened was it happened to come out just at the time of the Watts riot, which started on August 11th, 1965, ironically 5 days after Johnson had signed the Voting Rights Act. It lasted for 5 days and nights. It was on television. It was a gruesome, awful thing, the worst riot we've ever had. And it conveyed an image of blacks as kind of angry and capable of violence and out of control.
James Patterson, author of a new book, Freedom is Not Enough. And if you've just joined us, the book we're talking about is titled Freedom is Not Enough, The Moynihan Report and America's Struggle Over Black Family Life from LBJ to Obama. The author is James Patterson. He's Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University. You can join us 800-433-8850. I'm going to open the phones early because there's someone on the phone named Dennis in Arlington. And Dennis, I gather you were a staff member at the time of the writing of the Moynihan Report.
Yes, good morning, Diane.
Good morning, sir.
I'm very glad to be able to congratulate Professor Patterson for his really objective and well-informed recollection of this hectic time. It was indeed. Dorothy Newman was the coordinator for Moynihan of the staff people who worked on the report. But I do recognize that the bad news is often gives rise to the idea of let's shoot the messenger, because it does create upset, especially in the sensitive days right after. It was only 11 years after the desegregation, and people were naturally concerned that any bad news, anything that looked embarrassing, would create a backlash against integration. So their reactions were really understandable, even though they were really unfortunate and undeserved. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling, Jim Patterson. Do you want to comment?
Well, I wish I knew your last name because I would put your name in the book. Can you give it to us?
Oh, yes. Dennis Johnston. I'm Dr. Dennis Johnston. I retired from the Labor Department many years ago. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. As you know, I talk about Paul Barton mainly in my book as the key staffer for Moynihan in the writing of this report. And he, Barton, has also written a manuscript, which he's been kind enough to let me have a copy of, which is something got a title of something like The Unpublished Moynihan Report. So he gets credit, but I'm afraid you didn't.
Thanks for calling, Dennis, and thank you for your work on the report. The question becomes, why did the leaking undermine the findings of the report?
Well, the leaking came out at a very bad time, as I've suggested, right in the time of Watts Riot. And what the Watts Riot did was, first of all, totally confuse and upset Johnson, who was in his ranch at the time it happened, and kept saying, after all I've done for them, why is this happening? And he was completely bewildered and thought that the blacks were being terribly ungrateful to him. It also surprised most of the civil rights leaders who had been focusing, as you know, on Southern problems of segregation and discrimination. Some, of course, like Whitney Young of the Urban League, were involved in urban problems, and Martin Luther King and others had addressed these, too. But the focus had been elsewhere. So this riot was a surprise to them, too. And they found themselves actually catching up with the militants of the masses. Martin Luther King went out there and tried to make a speech and calm these people down after the riot had been on, and they wouldn't. And one guy says, we don't want your dreams, Martin, referring to as I have a dream speech. We want jobs. And in other words, the movement seemed to be getting out of control, and they had to run to catch up with it.
And yet jobs were exactly part of what President Johnson proposed.
Well, he probably had them in mind. As I say, in his speech in Howard, he mentioned a lot of things. The Moynihan Report was not specific about what should be done. It was specific about talking about the problem. And a lot of people criticize the report for that. You've written a 78-page report, including footnotes and appendices. You've told us all that's wrong with our families, but you haven't told us what to do. And his answer was, well, we don't know yet what to do. We want to do something, and that's what this report is all about. And that's why it's subtitled A Case for National Action. But he was, as Dr. Johnson just said, a white messenger, and he was shot for the fact, because his report was so unrelievedly gloomy about what was happening with what he called a matriarchy. And he concluded by saying this was a tangle of pathology. And so blacks said, well, what do you know about the black family? How can you tell us what to do? And we're not all like that. And Moynihan had not said they were all like that. He was talking about the lower class black families, in which many of them were female headed. So he took a lot of flack from people who called him a racist. They said he was blaming the victim. There was a book of that name which was published. And when they finally had a planning report in late 1965, following up on Johnson's promise to call a White House conference, which he made in his speech, it was a much reduced thing here at the Washington Hilton Hotel. Moynihan wasn't invited even. They tried to get family problems of the family taken right off the agenda. And when the convention opened, the staffer running it for Johnson got up and tried to cool tempers because the people knew that Moynihan was there and they was afraid there was a problem. He said, I have it on good authority that no such person as Daniel Patrick Moynihan exists. And so people chuckled.
Wow.
But Moynihan was really cut out of the action. And when they had the final conference in June of 1966, a year after Howard, there was a big deal, 2,000 people at the Sheraton Park. Johnson spoke, A. Philip Randolph spoke, Thurgood Marshall spoke, but nothing happened.
And, of course, at the same time, Vietnam is going on. So you've got that distraction as well.
Yes, the escalation occurs. Sergeant Johnson announces it in late July, and he's obsessed and preoccupied with that and not interested in following up. He's mad at the civil rights leaders because of their support of the Watts rioters, and he doesn't want to antagonize them any further by by pursuing this Moynihan report, which they're all criticizing. So within a space of a few months, the initial great response, which led Johnson to make this speech that Moynihan wrote, turns into something very different. And the Moynihan report is consigned to oblivion, and no one ever talks about it. And if they do, they're likely to risk being called a racist.
And what you say is this is the story of a great missed opportunity.
Moynihan wrote a famous essay, subtitle of which was The Moment Lost. It was published in Commentary magazine in 1967, and he rehashed the history of all of this and said, yes, this was a moment lost in American history. We had a chance to really sit down and seriously study this issue and maybe get something done, and it was lost in a pandemonium of misunderstandings and deliberate falsifications.
Why the deliberate falsifications? Where did they come from?
Well, I've got one quote here from James Farmer, head of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality. Farmer, like other black leaders before the Moynihan was published, had talked on occasion about problems in the black family. They all knew there were problems. The Moynihan Report didn't tell experts anything they didn't already know. In fact, Kenneth Clark, a black psychologist, wrote a book, Dark Ghetto, which was published in March of 1965, just as Moynihan was writing the report, and he consulted him and cited Clark. And he used the phrase tangle of pathology, took it from Clark's own writings. So these people knew that what Moynihan said was true, that there were serious problems within these black families, very high rates of out-of-wedlock pregnancy, or illegitimacy was called then. To give you the statistic, it was 23.6% of all black babies in 1963 were born out of wedlock. Today it's over 70%. It's over 80% for first babies. It's over 90% in the ghettos. 23.6 in 1963 compared to 3 for whites, a multiple of 8. The white rate today, by the way, is around 28, so it's gone up at a higher rate because it started so low. So it's 70-plus now for blacks and 28 for whites and around 50 for Hispanics. And the overall percentage of babies born out of wedlock in this country is 41%.
What do you think President Johnson could have done had this whole report been received differently?
That is a very good question. And you probably would expect me to say, as Moynihan did, that this was a moment lost. But I tend to think that, and I think most experts agree, although you find people who don't, that the decisions that people make upon whether to get married or not to get married and have children, not have to have children, are decisions beyond the capability or the competence of outside forces to do very much about. Better sex education maybe can make a dent here and there. But, roughly 50% of pregnancies in this country are unintended. This despite the pill. You just have what you've had over this time is a great sense that people have a personal freedom and the right to act the way they have, and the stigma that was so strong about getting knocked up, as they said, has long since gone. Shotgun marriage no longer exists. And so really very little government can do about the fact that there are so many illegitimate children.
But if you connect the notion of the child born out of wedlock to economic issues, how do you make that link?
Well, it's true that the out-of-wedlock pregnancies are mostly confined to relatively poor black people and relatively poor white people. I mean, you don't find women students at Brown University, some of whom are having sex, getting pregnant. They know what to do, and they're careful, and they use birth control reliably. This does not seem to be the case with the mass of poor people. So, yes, you could argue that if you could do away with poverty or make a sharp dent in it, you would have people who would... You would have young black men, for instance, this is what Moynihan and Johnson thought, young black men who were earning living wage, secure jobs, therefore thinking, well, I can get married. The women saying, hey, this guy is a decent prospect. Not that women are all that calculating, but an awful lot of black women today and lower class white women don't want to marry some of these people. They're very poor prospects. William Julius Wilson, a famous black scholar, said these were unmarriageable males. So if you could somehow provide a stable situation for them, you might alleviate this problem. This was Moynihan's main notion, jobs and family allowances such as European countries have. I tend to think this wouldn't make a huge difference.
You really don't think it would have done much to change the course?
There are so many other things happening. This notion that you have the freedom to act as you want. And besides, how secure would a government job be? How long haul would it be? How generous would they be? What would they do? What would conservatives and others say about the cost of these things? These have always had very difficult political prospects.
Brown University Professor Emeritus James Patterson, his new book is titled Freedom Is Not Enough. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Mike in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning to you both. I just wanted to say that, you know, American social policy has never been very friendly to families, regardless of color. Back in the day, in the 60s, the anti-poverty programs were called Aid to Families with Dependent Children. However, as long as an able-bodied or so-called able-bodied man was in the household, that household was not eligible for aid, regardless of social conditions, economic realities, personal foibles. This so-called able-bodied man may not have been had opportunities. And I have to disagree with the professor a little bit that, you know, regardless of the length of a government job or whatever, imagine if what our infrastructure would look like now if maybe some of those people had been put to work doing infrastructure jobs.
It's interesting, that notion. 2 points. The infrastructure jobs, which certainly have been talked about in this economic downturn, but also that ruling that if a man was in the house, that family could not receive assistance. Did that make sense?
It did not.
It turned the family against itself.
It created pernicious incentives. You see, if the woman wants to get a benefit through AFDC, Aid to Families with Dependent Children, as you've just said, if she had a man living in the house, whether it was a husband or an ex-husband or a boyfriend, he had to hide. He would take the shoes out of her closet and stuff like that. Well, there weren't too many searches, but clearly, if you wanted to get aid, you had to be a single parent. And Charles Murray and other conservatives argued that it was because of this welfare program which grew enormously in the late 60s and early 70s, that you had so many women with children born out of wedlock, because there was a kind of an incentive to do so.
Exactly.
Because you would get aid.
Exactly. And what about Robert Novak and the role his column played in turning people against what Johnson and Moynihan were trying to do?
Yeah, Novak and his colleague, what was his name now? I can't remember.
It'll come to me.
Yes, they wrote one of the most widely read syndicated columns in 1965, called the Moynihan Report. It was then, in fact, that the report, The Negro Family, which didn't have his name on it, became known as the Moynihan Report, and Moynihan became a household name. And this was generally accurate in most respects, but and as I say, it really brought Moynihan's name to the public attention in August of 1965.
Brought Novak's name to public attention.
No, Moynihan's.
Moynihan's name to public attention, and turned people against him. It was Roland Evans.
That's it. Yes,
and Robert Novak.
Yeah, right.
I'm sorry.
I
know that that column had an awful lot of readers for a very long time, so that it had a lot of influence with thinking, reading, doing people.
It also had, you know, was written in the immediate aftermath of the Watts riot, and one of the central messages was, you know, this country may be out of control. These people may be out of control. These people like to riot and looting in Watts. Maybe the Moynihan Report or something like it would do something about this.
James Patterson, the book we're talking about is titled Freedom Is Not Enough, The Moynihan Report, and America's Struggle Over Black Family Life from LBJ to Obama. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
A Reader's Review marks the 50th anniversary of Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, the Pulitzer Prize-winning classic all about racial injustice and loss of innocence in a small southern town. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We're back. Brown University Professor Emeritus James Patterson is with me. His new book, all about the Moynihan Report, the speech that President Johnson gave, a commencement speech at Howard University back in 1965, is titled Freedom Is Not Enough. Want to ask you about Bill Cosby. His portrayal of the black family on television, a very middle-class family, middle-class values. How do you think that and Bill Cosby's subsequent statements regarding black families have affected the debate?
Yes, the Cosby Show, of course, which ran in the late 80s, was the most popular show on television, and he and his television wife on the show, of course, and their upwardly mobile and respectful children. It was a fantastic show, and a lot of people then and particularly now credit that show with greatly advancing understanding and awareness of the fact that not all blacks are alike, and that they're good people and deserving people, and if given a chance, they'll do all right. And then, as you say, he emerges somewhat to everybody's surprise when he gave this really wild speech on the 50th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which was on in May of 2004, to a large and well-dressed audience at Constitution Hall in Washington, in which he really laid into black people, really smashing them, lower-class black people in particular, for sleeping around, for fathering a lot of children that they weren't bearing responsibility for running around in baggy trousers, for being disrespectful, for using bad language, for dropping out of school, for everything. And the audience sat there stunned for a while, but after a while, most of them stood up and applauded him. He continued to make this message and later wrote a book with Dr. Alvin Poussin called Come On, People. So he's been very active in pushing blacks to get their act together.
What is your reaction to Bill Cosby's attempt to get their attention and to perhaps try to get the conversation moving again?
I'm all for him. I mean, I totally agree with him. And one of the problems, you see, was after the Moynihan Report was consigned to oblivion, because whites like Johnson and others refused to risk being denounced as racists, this pretty well lasted. It was a great silence for a long time. And various people like Eleanor Holmes Norton, Benjamin Hooks, Cosby in his show, and others tried to raise the issue. But oftentimes they were saying, you know, this is a racist report, and the only real problem that black families have is white racism, and it's not their fault. And so there really couldn't be much of a conversation. There hadn't been much of a conversation. So Cosby did try to reopen it. Whether he's had any success, hard to say. It's only been 5 years, 6 years.
And President Obama?
President Obama, actually, in his Audacity of Hope, has a passage, this was written before he became president, 2006, has a passage indicating he had read and understood the Moynihan Report, and he basically praised it and regretted the fact that so many voices had been silenced because of the fear of being called racists. It's quite a remarkable passage in the book. No one's ever mentioned it. And during his campaign and since, he's raised the issue on the 100th anniversary of the founding of NAACP in 2009, the 50th anniversary. He gave a speech in which he again said, you know, you can't just sit around watching Sports Center. You've got to be... you've got to do well in school, and you shouldn't be proud if you graduate from the eighth grade. Everybody should graduate from the eighth grade, and went on in that vein. And again, trying to get blacks to be a major part of any kind of resurrection of lower-class black family life in the city. But he's been too absorbed by too many other things, and he really hasn't had a chance to do much, as far as I can see.
All right, and let's see. Here's a message. Does Dr. Patterson know any poor black people? Because, according to our caller, Dr. Patterson has reduced them to a stereotype and don't ever call anyone's child illegitimate. I'm a big fan of personal responsibility, but it's so easy to criticize from the outside. And about brown students being more careful and responsible with their sexuality, I graduated, says our caller, from a university quite similar to Brown, and careful is not the term I would use to describe some of my classmates. The overall message there being, it's happening everywhere.
Well, by careful, I meant they're careful in their use of contraception. The out of wedlock situation is much more common in low-income people, whether white or black. I think that's a fact.
All right, let's go to Ed in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm delighted to hear somebody discussing the nuclear family and its dissolution as being at the root of many of our social ills. I live in St. Louis, and I look at the north side of St. Louis, which is dramatically impoverished. And if I look at and attempt to try and understand what is really at the core of it, is that the nuclear family has effectively ceased to exist there. And until there's some sort of, I applaud you for handling what is not a hot potato. This is like a white hot grenade that you've got the courage to discuss this, because that is politically incorrect to the extreme. But at the end of the day, I can't help but think it's really what needs to that lies at the core of the resolution of poverty in America.
Well, of course, I agree with you. I wouldn't have written a book. I mean, my awareness of these incredible statistics and the changes over time. Moynihan said, you know, if we didn't do something, the situation, as he put it, will feed on itself. But he had no idea how rapidly the out-of-wedlock situation would grow. I mean, when he, in the 23.6 of black babies born out of wedlock in 1963. And by the way, when I use the word illegitimacy, that was the word they used then. We use out of wedlock now. I don't use the word illegitimacy. Nobody does, I don't think. So now from 23.6, it was already 28 at the time Moynihan was writing the report in 1965. It was 38 by 1970. It was in the high 50s by 1980, and it was in the around 70 by the early 90s, and it's been there since. It can hardly get much higher, given the fact that there are a lot of middle-class blacks for whom out-of-wedlock pregnancy is no more a problem than it is for middle-class whites.
All right, to Liz in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi there. I just want to run across several of these points very quickly. I would suggest that that out-of-wedlock births among upper-middle-class and middle-class people are less frequent because we can afford abortions and not because we are more careful. And people who are on public health support, poor people, cannot get abortions because laws are written against it. The other thing I was going to originally make the point that has been made that much of these family dissolution symptoms are also occur in poor white families, and it's multi-generational poverty, women raising two generations of children and supporting them, men who do not or cannot work or else are completely absent, and I'm not certain that marriage as paramount as the notion that parents, whether married or not, should be a continuous presence, and there has to be competence in parenting. But we're looking at the need for structural changes. I'm thinking of Jeff
Kennedy. I'm afraid we're breaking up, Liz, but you've made some good points. Thank you.
Yes, it's true that abortion is much more available and much more used by middle and upper middle class people. I think I'm right in saying, you could correct me, that roughly one-fifth of pregnancies end in abortion, so it's quite common. But and it's certainly much more available and much more used by upper-middle-class people. But that's only part of a much larger story.
And to Atlantic City, New Jersey. Laura, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Diane. I love your show. I'm so glad you're talking about this.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask Dr. Patterson, does he really think that things have changed for the black male in this country? Because with the influx of illegal and legal immigration, them coming here, taking jobs, I mean, it's been very hard. They're coming here with clean slates, and our brothers, you know, they have criminal records that they never, you know, get clear of. So I was wondering if the doctor had any comments on that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you.
Diane, I loved your show.
Thank you so much.
Well, black poverty is down a little bit. It was actually over 50% in 1960, it's around 27% now. Black male is less likely to be poor than he was. But as you know, the incarceration of blacks is out of sight compared to what it used to be. The drug situation is much worse. The job situation, well, pretty well steadily ever since the Moynihan report and before, blacks have been three times as likely to be poor as whites and at least twice as likely to be unemployed. And a lot of the people, it would be a higher figure if you counted the ones who aren't even in the labor market.
So you're saying the black family is worse off today than it was during the Johnson administration.
I'm saying if you compare them to white families in terms of poverty and in terms of unemployment, the ratio is about the same, 3-1 or 2-1. Generally, poverty is not as widespread as it used to be. Unemployment is not as widespread in terms of the percentage of people who are this way. But the family situation is much worse. And if you regard fatherless families headed by poor women as an unfortunate thing, as I do, this is a much more common problem than it used to be. And this is a problem that Moynihan was most concerned with, and we don't have a good answer for it.
To Quincy, Illinois. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning. Professor, I have a question for you. I am an adjunct professor at Culver Stockton College, and I teach an American history course called Through Women's Eyes. Mm-hmm. The text I use is by Ellen Dubois and Lynn Dumanel.
Yes.
Their reference to the Moynihan Report is that it characterized the competence and power of the African-American woman in families and in their communities as, quote, pathological, a holdover from slavery still affecting black Americans. The report was intended to aid the advancement of African Americans, but written before the emergence of women's liberation, and it did so by blaming black women for the single-parent household. It could have had a powerful impact if it had not been for the long-standing strains of racial antagonism between the history of African American feminism reaching back through white-dominated women's movement in the early 20th century. Do you have any comments?
Yeah, all I can say is that I hope your students also read other things, because Moynihan said no such thing about black women. You cannot find anything to that extent in the report. What later feminists, and you're right, there weren't very many feminists around in 1965 as an organized movement, complained about justly was that Moynihan was concerned with improving the economic status of black men.
Right.
This was a time-bound report. And in 1965, and to some extent even now, it was the notion that the man was the breadwinner and the woman was the person who took care of the home. So if the man didn't have a job, that's when the trouble started. And he actually said in the report, it might be nice if somehow or other jobs now held by women, and he pointed out that black women were doing better than black men then, as they
Correct.
Are now.
Yeah.
If some of these jobs could be turned over to black men, it might be a good thing. Later on, of course, this infuriated, and rightly so, a number of women, feminist or otherwise. But he never did he say that black women were, you know, oversexed or immoral or careless or anything like that. He saw the problem as one of racism. He talked about a racist virus in the American bloodstream. He talked about three centuries of unimaginable mistreatment. I think your students should read the report.
So it's only pathological with respect to the configuration of jobs between men and women.
It was a pathological situation that he was referring to, that all of these things together, yes, the heritage of slavery, yes, the mass migrations to the city, yes, the lack of availability of jobs, all of these things. Nowhere in there can you find him blaming these people for their plight.
Thank you.
Carol, I'm so glad you called. Thank you. And finally, we'll go to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to say that you are an invaluable resource in the universe of talk radio or media itself, and you are not recognized nearly enough. And Dr. Patterson, just to kind of comment, the combativeness that is around this issue is really kind of detrimental, because everybody knows about the studies, the results, and everything. But, you know, what we should be recognizing is, you know, our wars of choice. You know, we went to Vietnam during that time. You know, 20, 30 years later, you know, we're in Iraq and Afghanistan. These are wars of choice. The war of choice could also be wars on illiteracy, wars on poverty, wars on joblessness, if you could kind of address those issues. Thank you.
What an eloquent statement.
Well, that's a large bunch of issues. Yeah, I wish we were not in all these wars, and I wish the money that was spent on them and the effort and the time and the thought that goes into these wars, what there is of it, were around to address the problems that you mentioned of joblessness and of poverty and so forth and so on. I'm nonetheless, I hate to say this, I've said it before, I'll say it again, I think the problem that the Moynihan Report addresses is not just poverty. It's the problem of families not having a father, and therefore being poor. In other words, that comes first, and in many cases, or intermixes with the problem of poverty. And so this is not an easy thing to fix with some kind of government program.
Brown University Professor Emeritus James Patterson, his new book, well worth reading, is titled Freedom Is Not Enough, The Moynihan Report, and America's Struggle Over Black Family Life from LBJ to Obama. Thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.